Welcome back to the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies at Stanford podcast. Come join us in the library. In a farm shed in Guizhou province, in rural southern China, there's an unlikely tool to be found beside the plow and the baskets. A 33-page handwritten manual for the local Buddhist priest titled The Ox King Ritual Petition. The provenance of a manuscript like this one defies what we typically understand about the Buddhist clergy and its texts. Copied by local priests living among the laity and kept in private homes across Guizhou and Yunnan, or sold in the Beijing Panjia Yuan, a flea market for antiques in the capital, these texts have been passed down through families of ritual masters. They reveal a lineage of rural priests who were not monastics, who did not shave their heads, and who evidently did not keep vows of celibacy. Just as striking is the content of the manual itself. The ritual described here is not for the priest's human neighbors, but for their beast of burden, the buffalo. Inside, praise and protection are devoted to the Ox King, a bovine deity residing in the Jetavana garden, an incarnation of the Buddha Shakyamuni himself, reincarnated in turn into a sacred draft animal who must not be slaughtered. According to this manuscript, the living buffalo is nothing less than a bodhisattva.
A bodhisattva is someone who is, by definition, sacrifices himself for others. And so then it's so appropriate. You see how would I put it, how Buddhist theology was harnessed to express the peasant's gratitude to the animal.
Today, in our second installment of Book Notes, we learn more about the cult worship of the Ox King and its equine counterpart, reading and discussing Meir Shahar's Kings of Oxen and Horses, Draft Animals, Buddhism, and Chinese Rural Religion, published with Columbia University Press last year. Meir Shahar is the Scholl N. Eisenberg Chair for East Asian Affairs at Tel Aviv University. A prolific writer, he is also the author of Crazy G, Chinese Religion and Popular Literature, and The Shaolin Monastery, History, Religion, and the Chinese Martial Arts, both of which we will touch on in the conversation ahead. He's also the author of Oedipal God, the Chinese Nuzha and His Indian Origins, co-editor of volumes on Chinese gods and animals, and translator for introductory texts on Chinese religion and literature in Hebrew. Shahar visited the Ho Center in April of 2024 in the midst of writing the book at hand to describe his fieldwork in rural China and what it taught him about local Buddhist gods and rituals. We'll start the conversation by touching on that talk, and we've included a link to its video in our show description if you want to see it for yourself. For now, let's open up Kings of Oxen and Horses. Hi, Meir. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're really excited about this and to talk about your new book, Kings of Oxen and Horses, especially because we saw a little bit of the genesis or maybe the final stages of you putting this book together when you visited the Ho Center in 2024. And, when I looked back at that talk and as I invite our viewers and listeners to do as well, I was struck first off by how you introduced the methodology of the work that you'd done behind this project, because it wasn't just a matter, right, of going back through texts that had maybe been neglected. Well, it was, but we'll get into that in a second. But rather, doing field work, being there in southern China with a research team, and you showed these photographs of you and that team meeting Buddhist leaders, but not the kinds of Buddhist monastics we might expect. Buddhist leaders among the laity who were far from celibate, who had families and who, had their own collections of scriptures, were not relying on some grand library or some canon. So I just want to ask about that first in terms of the background archival material and field material of this project. Can you tell us where you went, who you met, and what you ultimately found?
So you're absolutely right. You got the gist of my lecture. Yes, you are right. Usually when people think about Buddhism, they think Buddhist monks. They think monks. But in fact, in rural China, we find another type of Buddhist cleric. In remote villages in South China, we find people who are married, who have families, who do not shave their heads. And yet these people profess a Buddhist identity and they make a living or at least supplement their income from agricultural work as Buddhist ritualists. They conduct rituals on behalf of their rural neighbors, rituals for to bless people, to bless animals, and also mortuary rituals, that is to say, saving the souls of departed people, the deceased. Now, from the perspective of Buddhist studies, what is interesting about these people is that they attest to the presence of Buddhism even in the remotest communities, even in the remotest rural areas. You will find the presence of Buddhism incarnated in these people. And they reveal to us the role that Buddhism plays in the lives of ordinary Chinese people, that is to say, of ordinary peasants. And the role is a liturgical role, as they perform rituals. There is a scholar in Hong Kong, Tam Wai Lun, he defines this as liturgical Buddhism. Yes, this is not philosophy, this is not doctrine, this is not meditation, these are rituals. And because you know, Chinese people like us, what do they want in life? They want to be happy, to be healthy, to have children, to have money. They hope that in the afterlife they won't suffer too much. And this is what these Buddhist priests take care of. This is what they are needed for. Now, what is interesting, and you mentioned this, is that they conduct the rituals in accordance with written manuscripts, manuscripts that have been transmitted from master to disciple over many generations, usually within the same families. Usually, it is the father who transmitted the manuscript to his son, yes, or to his nephew. And you know, even the humblest village priest possess an entire library of scriptures. They have dozens, sometimes hundreds of handwritten manuscripts. And today they take them out of their tool sheds, you know. They lie there near their agricultural tools. So it's a remarkable discovery. You arrive to a remote village and there are manuscripts there. Now, the big question is, of course, how far back can we trace these manuscripts? The manuscripts have their dates, but these are the dates in which they were copied, not the dates in which they were originally written. So, briefly, I would say that, in my estimate, or as I see it, at least some elements in these scriptures, in these manuscripts that we find nowadays in remote Chinese villages, at least some elements in these manuscripts go all the way back to medieval China. Go all the way back 1,000 years, go all the way back to Dunhuang. So this is very, very interesting. For example, in these manuscripts, the buffalo, the ox, is described as a god who descended from heaven, sacrificed himself for the sake of the peasant. And this idea that the buffalo or the ox is a bodhisattva, is a Buddhist deity, is traceable all the way back to Dunhuang manuscript. Now, I guess you asked me, how do I find these people? Yes, how do we find them? And the answer is local contacts, local contacts. If it were not for, I always tell my students, you need to have Chinese friends. There's no other way. If it were not for my Chinese friends, my research would have been utterly impossible. So the way it works usually is this. I have a friend. In recent years, I've been working in Guizhou province, which is a very poor and remote province in South China. And I have a friend called Ho Chong, who teaches at Shanghai Normal University. He's a renowned professor. He has students who teach in local schools in Guizhou, who teach in local colleges in Guizhou. So he asked his students to ask their students, who are natives of Guizhou, whether they happen to know a Buddhist ritual master, you know. And the student might say, "Oh, my uncle, I think my uncle is a Buddhist ritual master." And then the question is, would he agree to meet a foreign scholar? And would he agree to have his manuscript scanned? Now I'm now managing a large project. I have graduate students, and we go there and we scan these manuscripts. So by the time we arrive at the village, we are an entire delegation. There's me, there's Ho Chong, there's his students, his students' students, my students. We come a big group of people. we descend upon this ritual master, and we try to, to work with him.
So I want to turn a little bit to the core of the project. So you mentioned just in passing that among all the other things that are maybe fascinating about this archive, finding texts that are specifically about an ox king or an ox god. And so it just makes me want to ask, as you were going through this, were you initially just interested in the ritual masters in and of themselves? Did you have in mind the idea that, oh, I'm going to be looking at local deities specifically and maybe agricultural deities? Which came first?
What came first? Well, it's a convoluted story. What came first were actually the gods. I became interested in the horse king who protects donkeys and horses and mules, and the ox king that protects oxen and buffaloes. I became interested in them, I guess, like 10 years ago or something like that. Also, because of a textual discovery in a village that I can tell you about. But this was a textual discovery in North China, and I can share it with you honestly. I gave a talk at Shanghai University about this horse king and ox king, and then this Professor Ho Chung, who I just mentioned, he was in the audience, and he said, "Hey, do you know that there are such things as ox king scriptures and horse king scriptures in South China?" I said, "No, I have no idea." So he said, "Yes, there are such scriptures in Guizhou." So that's how my research turned to Guizhou, and then from these two specific gods, also more generally into the Buddhist ritual tradition in South China.
So I just wanted to ask a little bit about sort of the construction of the book then, because you divide it into these two discrete parts where you're thinking about the ox king and the horse king. At certain points you're also thinking about other animals, about a fiery pig in a village festival, where we also think about, taboos involving other animals. How do you decide to kind of play those two traditions off one another? Because part of your argument is that they are distinct. They have different origin points in terms of different Buddhist gods that they sort of descend from or embody or represent. They have different footholds in China, whether, maybe more rural or more urban, more south or more north. But you also seem to see the value of not just categorizing, separating, but having them occupy the same space and the same monograph. So could you tell us a little bit about both the selection process and the juxtaposition and what that does for you?
So thank you very much. I mean, thank you for reading the book so carefully. I will go back to the. So there are two gods, you are right. There is the horse king and the ox king. Both of them, by the way, nowadays in China are largely forgotten simply because their proteges are no longer in use. People rely no more on horses to plow the field or on buffaloes to plow the rice paddies. So people have no use for the animals, and therefore the gods also became useless. But up until the 1950s, up until the mechanization of agriculture in the 1950s, these two gods were amongst the most popular in China. I first became, and both gods, as you mentioned, both of them have Buddhist antecedents. Both of them descend, have Buddhist origins. The horse king is a descendant of the horse-headed Avalokiteshvara, the horse-headed creature that came from India, the horse-headed Avalokiteshvara, or Guan Yin in Chinese. And the ox king is none other than the Buddha Shakyamuni, whose epithet, bull of a man, Nararishaba in Sanskrit, was translated into Chinese as ox king. So he's in fact the Buddha Shakyamuni. So both of them are animal protecting deities, both of them have Buddhist origins. But there are also differences between them. And one difference concerns state patronage or imperial patronage. So the ox king was by and large a rural god worshipped by peasants. By contrast, the horse king enjoyed the lavish support of the imperial Chinese state. And the reason is, of course, the enormous significance of the horse in pre-modern warfare. The imperial army, the cavalry was the backbone of the army, and the very lives of the cavalrymen depended upon the performance of their chargers in battle. And therefore, they all venerated the horse king. So the horse king was, in fact, a military god. He was a military god. And beginning in the Ming period, that is to say, in the say the 15th century, each and every military base in the Chinese Empire featured a shrine for the Horse King. He was worshipped there alongside other military gods. There is such a god as Guangong, is a popular god, and other gods. So this is one difference. The Horse King was enjoyed was in fact figured in state religion, whereas the Ox King was only an agricultural god. The other difference concerns, of course, the beef taboo. The Ox King protected the animals, protected the oxen and the buffaloes, not only from disease, but also from the very owners. That is to say, he made sure that their owners do not eat the animals. And as you know, if you ate beef, if you ate your ox, so of course the appropriate punishment was to be born as an ox. So those who ate beef were born as cattle. And it was the ox king who made sure of that, of this punishment.
And as you point out, that's one of the then becomes part of the rationale for not eating beef going forward, right? That it might be a family member who is that cow, who is that ox. But then you also you mentioned kind of the whole range of attitudes towards beef in Chinese religion. I mean, you've got on the one hand in Zhuangzi, Cook Ding being praised for being such a skillful butcher and that having no problem whatsoever. On the other hand, there being really intense, terrifying karmic punishments for beef eating that involve, having to swallow caltrops and being torn apart from the inside as a sort of punishment. And then you mentioned specifically, okay, well, we can understand this by way of saying perhaps one version of karmic reincarnation is to be born as a field animal, as a cow or as an ox, as a result of beef eating. But you also mentioned that the cow might be a god, right? And so you have these separate chapters where you think about the human ox case or the divine ox case. And so we're talking about various juxtapositions, the horse god and the ox king. Or there's also this juxtaposition of different ways of reasoning why this animal should be protected. What is the comparative case, and how do specific practitioners or ritual masters either choose between those two possibilities or maintain both of them?
I think that I always tell my students that when it comes to religion, the human mind is very strange, as you know, our mind is very strange. People can live with contradictions. Yes, they don't try to solve. They don't try. I'm giving another example, which is not related to the ox king and the horse king. I'm now reading texts, rituals for saving the souls of the dead. So in China, there was this idea that after we die, all of us, we go down to the netherworld, and there are 10 kings, and they are judges, and they, screen our life for us to see. They show us all the evil things that we did in our life. And in order to escape punishment, you have to, your kins, your remaining kin, the kins you left, have to make sacrifice to these judges. Essentially, it's a bribe. They bribe the judges. So there are these elaborate rituals that are meant to help you in the netherworld to mitigate, or to redeem your sins. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, there is also a belief that if before you die, you say the name of the Bodhisattva Amitabha, and you sort of concentrate, you really think about it, and you say Amitabha, Amitabha Buddha, this in enough will atone for, this itself will atone for all your sins, and you will go straight to paradise. Now the interesting thing, of course, is that people didn't rely only on this method or that method. They employed both. They didn't say, well, if I say Amitabha, then my relatives need not sacrifice to the kings of the netherworld. They did both things. I don't know. So, people don't, they don't,
So we
they
can
have no
understand
problem
the
with the,
yeah, we can
they
understand
have
the
no problem. They have no problem holding simultaneously to contradictory beliefs, yes, as long as it might be helpful to them. Now, going back to the ox king, or to the conception of the ox, so it's true. Chinese literature, on the one hand, and in fact, when they say ox, what they think about is the buffalo. They think about the animal that was really the cornerstone of rice agriculture. You think about the buffalo that wades through the rice paddies. So on the one hand, the buffalo is described in Chinese literature as human. You know, he's a human being. And on the other hand, he's described as a god who sacrificed himself for our sake. And both these conceptions, both these concepts of the buffalo, they mirror the gratitude of the peasant to his animal companion. That's how I see it. I wasn't aware of this before going into this field, but the buffalo is apparently an incredible animal. You know, it can work for 30 or 40 years, meaning that a Chinese peasant, a Chinese rice farmer, might have spent much of his own career toiling in the fields with the same animal that he knew since childhood. So you can imagine working together for 20 or 30 years, that the camaraderie emerged between the animal and its human master. They work together in the fields. Yeah, I have a dog, yes. It's nothing like that. I don't work with it, but even the dog is part of the family.
Right.
Yes. When we think about it, when we are planning a sabbatical for next year, and our biggest worry is how to take the dog on the plane or how to, you know, it's like it's a member of the family. How much more so for a Chinese farmer who usually owned not more than one buffalo. The buffalo was the, because they were very expensive, these
Yeah.
animals. So the animal was really the major, the principal asset, economic asset of the family. So it was really like treated like a human. This is on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is, of course, there emerged this beautiful legend that the animal is a god and a bodhisattva, the Buddhist term bodhisattva. And of course, for those of our listeners who are, you know, conversant with Buddhism, what is a bodhisattva? The very essence of a bodhisattva is self-sacrifice. A little bit like Jesus in Christianity, yes? A bodhisattva is someone who is, by definition, sacrifice himself for others. And so then it's so appropriate. You see how would I put it? How Buddhist theology was harnessed to express the peasant's gratitude to the animal. So the animal was conceived of as a bodhisattva, a creature who descended from heaven for our sake, to help us plow the fields. He assumed animal form for our benefit. And because he is a god, then of course eating it is not only thankless, it is sacrilegious. It is a sin, a religious sin.
You can see so much meaning laden onto this animal, along with the physical things that this animal has to bear, to be a family member, some, an animal you grew up with, an animal you might well imagine as taking on family members past, a god who's doing the sacrificial work for you, all reasons to protect this animal from disease, to protect this animal from being slaughtered by nature of the debt that you have to it in the past, the need you have for it in the future. It makes sense. Well, in the process of that beautiful description, you mention wonderful legends that surround these particular animals. And that makes me want to ask you about a really just very enjoyable part of the book where, throughout Kings of Oxen and Horses, you're talking about your personal adventures in kind of figuring out this story and finding these ritual masters. And that takes you from everywhere from using your network of friends, as you mentioned, to get into the notebooks of the Horse King Association in Shaanxi Province, which is a great moment, or in the epilogue, knocking on doors in France and Brittany to figure out how there is a French tradition of patron saints of horses and do a little bit of kind of comparative cultural work there. All of these are really lovely anecdotes. But the one that I thought I might ask you about is at the end of part one, where you talk about going to the Horse King Festival in Huanghuayu Village, where you witness this elaborate performance in this remote agrarian community, where we have the story of maybe how one story of how the Horse King came to be deified, and his alliance with a fiery pig god. And then in the final lines, you say, And I can let you play out why this is. I'll hand it over to you. But you say there's something here going on where village theater exhibits the anxieties of the scholarly elite, where we might think of those as two separate worlds, and yet the dialogue that's happening in the shadow play actually totally speaks to doctrinal issues that were present to the recent empire. So tell us a little bit about that moment of epiphany and what you were watching and what went through your head.
Yeah, thank you. I'm not sure it, a great discovery. But the thing is this: the funny thing about the horse king, if I'm trying to remember now this chapter that you asked me about, the funny thing is that the horse king is called in Chinese Ma Wang. Ma Wang just means Ma is horse and Wang is king. But Ma in Chinese is also happens to be a common surname of the Muslim minority. You know, there are many Muslim people in China, and their surname, the Chinese surname, is usually Ma. So for this reason, over the centuries, the Buddhist origins of the horse king were forgotten. This is my research. I discovered that he has Buddhist origins, but you know, ordinary people forgot that he has Buddhist origins, and instead people said that he's M Muslim. It's a funny idea. The God is Muslim. So if the God is Muslim, so presumably he follows halal, you know, he follows Muslim kosher laws, and he doesn't eat pig. You know, like he can't consume pig. This is in fact, this is a fact of the cult that all across China, when they worship the horse king, they refrained from offering him pork. They offered him, when they offered meat, they offered lamb, but not pork. Now the play that you mentioned that I watched in that village, the play makes the elaborate plot of the play has a pig, a kind of a fiery pig, a pig deity, assist the horse king in his battles, something like that. And then the play concludes with the comment that because the pig helped him, so the horse is grateful. Therefore, he shouldn't be offered pork in sacrifice. In other words, somehow the play is a sort of a scholarly attempt by by a Chinese scholar or writer to disassociate, to get rid of this folk belief that the god is Muslim. Somehow, someone thought that this is sacrilegious, that this is ridiculous, that these are the ignorant people, and we should tell them better. So, no. Yes, you're not going to sacrifice, give him pork, but we will provide a different explanation. And the play provides this explanation, the plot of the play.
Yeah, that's great. And I guess it just makes me wonder about your methodology and your approach and, going from this very particular field work and almost anthropological observational work to writing a monograph like this. What should be the dialogue between sort of rural practice and religious scholasticism? Like you're seeing a version of it in that play, but is this a way for you also to say we need to attend to the ways in which these doctrinal issues, which we think of as being the matter of kind of high philosophy or sort of religious doctrine, are also being played out in these other spheres, and that's a different way of understanding them.
Yes. And yeah, absolutely yes. In fact, I will permit myself to say that from the very beginning of my career, I always combined textual work with field work. I always did it. I'm not sure it's going to be of interest to your audience, to our audience, but I did my PhD at Harvard many years ago under the guidance of a great scholar, Patrick Hannon, a scholar of Chinese literature, by the way, not of religion, a scholar of Chinese literature. And we were reading Chinese novels together. And well, my Chinese was not so great then, but I'm not sure it's great now. But the teacher, Professor Hannon, was very generous. And he was a great scholar, by the way, Patrick Hannon. And then after, I remember, for example, we read a novel about a sort of a clownish Buddhist figure called Ji Gong or Ji Dian, which I later translated as Crazy Ji. He's a kind of a clownish monk who is also, in fact, a god in disguise. Anyway, so I read these novels at Harvard. Then I went to Taiwan to study Chinese, to improve my Chinese. And in Taiwan, I had Chinese friends, and I told them about that I'm reading these novels or read these novels. And they told me, you know, there are temples here. He's worshipped. There are temples in which this literary figure is worshipped as a god. And they took me to these temples, and they also introduced me to spirit mediums who are possessed by this god. Who are possessed. Imagine it's as if you watch a Superman movie, and then you arrive somewhere, and it turns out that there are temples to Superman, and there are also people who are possessed by him, wear his uniform, and act his role. And act his role. So this was the discovery. So this was also my first book, titled Crazy G, Chinese Religion and Popular Literature. That is to say, seeing the connection between literature and religion. But there are other examples. You know, it's always also very interesting how people understand ideas in way that surprise you. I will give just one example from the realm of martial arts, of Chinese martial arts. There is in Buddhism, in Tantric Buddhism, there is the symbol of the diamond. The diamond. In Sanskrit, it's Vajra, Vajra, which means diamond. And there is a god called Vajrapani who holds the diamond. And the diamond is a very important, this Vajra is a very important symbol in a form of Buddhism called Tantric Buddhism or esoteric Buddhism. Now, what does it mean, this diamond? So I guess for Buddhist philosopher, for highly educated Buddhist monks, it is a symbol of enlightenment, a symbol of nirvana. It's the perfect knowledge. It's, you know, they take it as a symbol of what we are looking for: clarity, wisdom, enlightenment. You know, this is, you know, nirvana. This is the diamond. But at the Shaolin Monastery, at the Shaolin Monastery, you might have heard about it. It's a center of the Chinese martial arts. At the Shaolin Monastery in China, they take it literally. They think that if they practice the martial arts, they will obtain a diamond body. They will obtain a body that is like a diamond, meaning a body that you can't, that is impenetrable, that you can't, you know, you will take. And this is, you know, a common act in Chinese martial arts. They come on stage and they say, "Beat me," "beat me or stab me." You know, "I can stand it. I can stand it." So, and the terminology they use is the terminology of the Vajra. Now, of course, not all of them take it so literally, but there's a clear connection. There's a clear connection between the diamond as a mystical sort of a symbol of enlightenment and the diamond as the promise of an eternal body that I will practice and I will get a body that will carry me to immortality. I will be invulnerable to disease. And I will also be invulnerable in battle, in the battlefield. So again, you know, you take an abstract symbol, but you understand it in a very concrete way and material way, which, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense, and it's so germane to the current book and the argument that you've been making, that on the one hand we can think of, you know, ox kings and horse kings as ethereal figures or figures from the ancient past, or as kind of symbolic conduits between an ancient Indian history and a contemporary or medieval Chinese history. But we also have to remember that these are beasts of burden and members of a living family and the lifeblood of work that happens in these worlds. So the literal matters as well. You know, all of this just
Yes.
makes me want to conclude by asking, and I'm sure my audience will be wondering this as well, where are you headed next? You mentioned you have a sabbatical coming. You know, presumably there's a project. You've had all these fascinating travels that have led you to so many you know, curious discoveries already. What are you looking for now?
So, yeah, I in fact, we have been talking about this. We have already been talking about my coming project, which is, you know, in the book Kings of Oxen and Horses, I discuss the Kings of Oxen and Horses. It's not a book about the lay priesthood of South China, but I guess the lay priesthood of China, of South China, is going to be hopefully my next book. I'm leading this project now with the support of the Israel Science Foundation. I'm leading this project where we go, as I mentioned, to Chinese villages in Guizhou province, where we scan their writings, and we scanned already hundreds, many hundreds of scriptures. So, and I have a team, and we hope to catalog them, perhaps put these scriptures online so that people all over the world can read them and read these scriptures. This would be one product, just an on a website where the scriptures are
Yeah,
available to other
wonderful.
people. And perhaps I will also write a book about these people and their scriptures, perhaps, hopefully.
Yeah. All right, terrific. And can you, as this is an episode where we're sort of featuring recent books in Buddhist studies, can I just also ask, are there things you're reading outside of these primary sources that you'd recommend that you have on your own bookshelf?
Yeah, I actually wrote the title of a book that I would like to mention.
Hmm.
It's by, I don't know if you if she came up in your interviews or in your book series, Susan Huang, Sheshan Susan Huang. She teaches at, I think, at Rice University, and she's a historian of Chinese art originally, but she wrote a fantastic book already, I guess 10 years ago, about Taoist art. It's called Picturing the True Form. Picturing the True Form, because in Taoist art, they sort of strive to find the true form of things. And for example, instead of going on a pilgrimage to a mountain, if the artist can paint the true form of the mountain, then you can visit it from your office. You can have the painting in your office. You don't have to go on a pilgrimage. So she wrote a book about Taoist art, which is really about a book about Taoism, and now she just completed an enormous book called The Dynamic Spread of Buddhist Print Culture, Mapping Buddhist Book Roads in China and Its Neighbors. It's an amazing book. It's incredibly long. It's 1,000 pages, and she starts by examining how illustrations from Buddhist books traveled all across Asia. And then she goes on to discuss how books traveled and how publishing centers, Buddhist publishing centers emerged across Asia. So it's a magnificent book, both in terms of Buddhism and in terms of print culture and in terms of international relations all across Asia through
Yeah.
Buddhism. I highly recommend it by Susan Huang.
That's great. Thank you so much. And yeah, nice to have the recommendation and to have things in mind for, future guests and future episodes, as you've suggested there, and to have something that is itself, in an episode about books, in Buddhist studies about historical Buddhist print culture. So a very appropriate note to end on. Well, thanks so much, Meir, for doing this, for talking to us, for sharing your work. We'll be recommending your book to our readers. And we hope to see you around the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies again sometime for a talk on a future project.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks again to Meir Shahar for joining the show and talking about his work. You can get a copy of the book, Kings of Oxen and Horses, from the Columbia University Press website at cup.columbia.edu. If you'd like to see images of Shahar's research team with a rural priest, or a few of the Ox King ritual manuscripts, or illustrated punishments for beef eaters, take a look at the video version of this interview on our YouTube channel. As we sign off, here, as always, is Ani Choying Drolma performing at Stanford in 2017. Thanks for listening.
Tara ki.